Welcome to our podcast series, Talking with Traders, hosted by expert trader Garth McKenzie in London, from where he's interviewing various guests on the topic of trading.
Welcome to Season 2 of the Talking with Traders podcast series with me, Garth McKenzie. In this season, I'll be interviewing various successful traders and investors in my network and asking them pertinent questions about their career in the financial markets. I'll also be discussing how they've dealt with the recent surge in market volatility following the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic and how they are viewing the future as we all adjust to a new way of working. We'll also be talking about market themes that are likely to gain traction in a post-COVID-19 world. Joining me on this podcast is Dr. Adrian Saville of Cannon Asset Managers. Adrian and I first met back in about 2001, I think it was, Adrian. I was at Deal Smith Securities, and upstairs in our building was SA Stockbrokers. And you rented a small little office. I think it was like a 3 meters by 3 meters office in the corner of the dealing room at SA Stockbrokers, where you started out as Cannon Asset Managers. And I remember at that time, you used to fly up and down to Durban every week, once or twice, to go and lecture at the University of Natal. So we go back a long time, and we've gradually kept in contact over the years. So it's wonderful to chat to you again, and welcome to the podcast.
Brilliant to be with you, Garth. It's amazing, you know, what can happen over the course of 20 years. But, you know, they say life sort of can travel full circle. So here I am speaking to you again from my little 3x3.
And I'm in my little 3x3, and I'm in the UK this time. So, but technology has allowed us to do this, which is wonderful.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Adrian, if we go back to the right to the beginning of your career, I'd love to find out what got you involved in the stock market and where your interest was first spawned and how your career progressed from there.
Garth, I wouldn't say my interest in investing started in a work environment or as a career. In fact, my interest in investing started even before I knew, you know, you could do this as a job. And it was all the way back in my high school years where I was introduced to the market by an accounting teacher. And our project was to build fictitious portfolios. That was given, you know, as a class assignment, and I must have been 13 or 14 at the time. And I became absolutely fascinated by this living, breathing, moving animal that changed its mind each day about the value of a currency, a commodity, or a company. And that project developed into a fully fledged fascination with capital markets and economies that I think I could now sort of safely venture is a 40-year-old hobby, if I add, you know, my 13 years, the 4 decades brings me to early 50s.
Mm, yeah, it's amazing. So many of the guys that I have interviewed on these podcasts have some sort of a similar story to tell, where they became interested at school in some way or another through a stock exchange challenge or through a parent that was interested or something like that. And it's amazing. Yeah. Once that bug has bitten, it just never, ever seems to leave you.
And yeah, you know, I would add in my family circumstance also, in that my father in particular sort of fed this market interest because of his business interests. He ran a JSE-listed company. You know, he would travel internationally and come back from, you know, fascinating places as wide and varied as Japan and Brazil. My favorite sort of bring home treat was when he would arrive home with the business day tucked under his arm, and I would, you know, page through it trying to gather, you know, evidence and arguments and stories. And my mom also had a business interest, which started as a I think the word is a hustle or a gig, and turned out to be a fully fledged business that she went on to sell. So you know, I had this family environment also that fed my interest and intrigue.
Yeah, it's fascinating that, and I mean, I'm sure you've read the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, and he talks about
Indeed.
how your family circumstances can set you up for success. So it certainly sounds like you were teed up nicely for a very successful career. But now, if we take it a step further, after high school, you've been looking at markets, you've been playing the markets fictitiously since you were 13 or 14 years old. You ultimately ended up becoming a professional in this business. What did you do thereafter? I mean, you've got a PhD in economics, so obviously you've studied a lot. And looking at your bio, I see that you cum laude to all of your studies. So, very clever guy. But what was what? How did your career sort of evolve from the beginning of your professional career?
So there's a little bit of color in that story also, I suppose. In that I was politically active, and that made that obliged me to go to university. The alternatives in South Africa were leave the country or go to jail, or go to the military. And I went into university in the second half of the 1980s and started with, hold your breath, a commerce degree, which I flipped to an arts degree. And that was to my father's absolute horror that I abandoned accounting and instead went and did psychology, sociology, economic history. And I mean, with the benefit of hindsight, I'm going to argue to you, and will still argue with my dad, that it was probably one of the most valuable tips or tilts, or should we use the word pivot, that I did, because I mean, my experience over the 25 years of managing money now has been that you can do the numbers. You know, almost anyone can do the numbers. Can you do the behavior and the psychology? And then what's the context? So my early degree, or my initial degree, my bachelor's degree, was an arts degree. And in that I did law and economics as my majors. And it was economics that turned into my absolute love. And then I did an honors and master's degree in economics. And I took a very small break to do a bit of sort of feet finding, and then returned to university after a 1 year work break to do a doctorate. And while I was finishing my doctorate, so for all intents and purposes, I would argue I did my academic career in a straight line, bachelor's, honors, master's, doctorate. And while I was progressing through my doctorate, I confided in a close friend, and I said to him, you know, my anxiety is you guys are getting jobs and establishing work experience. I've got qualifications on my CV, but you know, I'm not sure that I'm employable. And he said, but you've got some really valuable skills. You know, we're starting for the first time in our lives to actually have incomes, and we might have something called disposable income. I'm not sure he called it that. But you know, you know how markets work and you understand investing. Why don't we form a club? And that was actually the origins of the business, where in 1994, we put together an investment club. And that investment club met once a month, 12 subscribers initially. And we started to build a pool of capital. I was responsible for managing the money. And 3 years later, we had a sufficient pool of capital to actually justify licensing the company. Actually, it wasn't the pool of capital, it was the number of people interested in the partnership that justified the licensing. And out of that, a company called Bay Hill Capital Advisors was born. Bay Hill then iterated to become Cannon Asset Managers. So Bay Hill is the original name of the company, and it was a very, very clever name because I was based in Durban, and at the time, the Hill was the university. If anyone knows Durban as a city, the old campus of Howard College is up on the hill, and it overlooks the CBD, which is in the Bay. And so my first business partner, Craig Simpkins, very cleverly suggested this extraordinary name, Bay Hill Capital Advisors, and we were off to dominate the world.
What a fascinating story. And I mean, of those 12 guys that you started out with in an investment club, are they all still involved? Are they still all investors in some form, or have they peeled away over the years?
You know, I mean, that is such a cool question, which if the answer was awkward, I'd need to find a way to dodge it or duck it. But you know, I'm delighted to tell you that most of them are still invested with me in some shape or form. There's a tiny bit of double counting in that one of those 12 is me and another one is my brother. So, you know, maybe they do or don't count. Of those 12, most are still my clients in some shape or form. And in fact, you know, some of them, as individuals and clients, have extraordinary stories to tell where, you know, obviously I can't disclose any identities, but people who've done the 20-year yards, so we're rewinding to 1998, people who've done the 21-year yards of compounding have turned, you know, relatively modest monthly allocations into quite substantial capital piles.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, you've gone through a couple of bull markets during that time, and if you've picked a few of the right stocks, and as you say, compounded, reinvested your dividends, it becomes an incredibly powerful force over time. But that kind of leads me on to the next question for you, Adrian, and that is really, what is your primary investing strategy or trading strategy? And I think it's probably not fair to say trading, because as I understand it, you very much fit into the investment camp. But what would you if you had to sum it up very briefly, what is your primary strategy of how you look after money?
My initial experience and exposure was really with asset allocation. And it was, so I would describe myself initially, fundamentally, as an asset allocator. If you get asset allocation wrong, it doesn't matter how brilliant you are with your underlying strategy, you're in the wrong asset class. You know, it's like owning the best company in Venezuela. It'll be a disaster.
Yeah.
So I would describe myself first, and I think this speaks to my roots as an economist, that I'm fundamentally interested in strategic and then tactical asset allocation. Once you've got that right, you know, then I think that there's all types of things that you can do. The most powerful asset class, the most important asset class to me, is equities. And if you give me a patient enough investor with a long enough horizon, I think you want to go and buy unloved stuff. And you can call this contrarian, you can call it value, not distressed investing. I think that that's a very particular type of investor and requires a very specific skill. But, you know, finding unloved, ignored, overlooked, under-researched assets, to me, that is the most fascinating place to work. But you need a lot of patience, you need a stomach to tolerate the volatility, and you need a long investment horizon. But I would describe those as sort of my two sort of core principles: asset allocation first, and then the ability to work with bottom-up valuation.
Okay. And that, I guess, very much talks to your Superdogs portfolio, which is something that's a name that's become well known and synonymous with your firm. And that's a minimum investment of 100,000 Rand, if I'm not wrong, that people can invest in if they want to follow that strategy of yours.
Yeah, you know, so Superdogs actually started as a back of the envelope exercise. Now I'm old fashioned; envelopes no longer exist, right? But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
We're old enough together. Yeah. And in mid 1990s, just before I started the company, I, you know, set out with this exercise to my wondering was, what would happen if I bought good companies, i.e. they are profitable, dividend paying, with decent balance sheets. That was my definition of good at the time, and held them and, you know, let them work as a portfolio. And that that project was actually initiated by a conversation with Paul van Rensburg, who has a well-known reputation in the investment industry. And Paul and I were colleagues at the time. He was a professor in finance. I was a professor in economics. And he said to me, "You know, have a look at this." And it was some really interesting research that led to the formation of this fictitious portfolio. And after a couple of years of the fictitious portfolio, I went and I built the real portfolio. And that was the portfolio that is the powerful compounder that I'm describing today, that's run on for just over 20 years, packing down a compound 20-odd percent per annum over the 20 years.
Phenomenal. And that becomes massive over time if you can continually compound at that rate.
Yeah, I mean, if you take the rule of 72 and divide it by 20, you get a doubling of your money every 3.5 years. Not three and a half in and out, but in the fullness of time, it gets you there.
It gets you very far. And I mean, if you're a youngster listening to this podcast, just, you know, rewind and listen to those few sentences again and know that if you can, you know, use time to your advantage, time is your greatest asset in the investment world. Use it wisely and remember to keep your eyes set on the long-term horizon. You can make a hell of a lot of money if you compound successfully over the years. But Adrian, now, obviously, we've all got a story, all of us that have been in the market for a couple of decades, and no doubt you've got some stories as well. And something I've been asking all of the interviewees on this podcast series is about their best and worst investments. So maybe let's start with the worst. What stands out in your history as being one of the worst investments or trades that you've ever done? You're listening to Talking with Traders, a podcast series brought to you by IG, a world-leading online trading and investment provider. If you haven't checked out the IG online trading platform, please do so and visit IG.com. Also, make sure you subscribe to the podcast series on your favorite podcast app or website by clicking on the subscribe button, and you'll be notified weekly as we release new episodes.
Garth, I could give you quite a few companies or examples where I've experienced permanent destruction of capital. And to me, that's the single risk that you want to avoid. You know, if it's one name in a portfolio and it's a 30 stock portfolio, you've just blown up 3% of the portfolio. You can recover from that. But to me, investing is all about managing risk. It starts with risk management. And so I could, you know, give you, I don't want to use the word pepper you with examples. I think that that would be not the best advert for my skill or capability, but I can certainly give you examples of businesses that have blown up in our hands. The most recent example I can share with you is Group 5, where you know, our valuation of the business was, it's really made up of a couple of parts: a building, engineering, construction component, a manufacturing component, and then a concessions business, which owns toll concessions in Europe, a fantastic annuity business. Yeah. Well, with the benefit of hindsight, it wasn't a fantastic annuity business because it didn't have the ability to protect against the disastrous mistakes that were made in silo one and silo two, the construction and manufacturing businesses. And so we've seen a 20 Rand share price collapse to zero. The business is worth nothing. So that's my most recent mistake. You know, I could share with you in 25 years of investing a number of other experiences that have turned into portfolio setbacks. You know, I'm pleased, you know, to tell you in pointing to, you know, that type of example, that it's always a portfolio mistake, and you can recover from those portfolio mistakes. What you can never recover from is if you bet the farm on that single business. And that's when, you know, risk management goes out the window. Not so much mistake, but massive frustration is when you realize with the benefit of hindsight that that the horses bolted. And you know, I can think of, well, two examples that I repeat often enough that I guess they count as scarring. The one was very early on in my investment career when I bought into a gold mine called Deelkraal, no longer listed. And Deelkraal I bought in at 2 rand. It was late 1980s, and so I wasn't managing other people's money. It was my money. And it was early earnings from my spectacular career as a mobile disco jockey. And I put some money into Deelkraal at 2 rand a share. This was gold price boom time. And the share price galloped up to 24 rand, at which point I thought I was the most extraordinary investor of all time, and it quickly tanked back to 2. So my 2.24.2 is a reminder of the importance of timing after time in the market. Mm-hmm. And then not very recently, but more recently, global financial crisis, we were invested in a copper business called Metarex.
Yes.
And Metarex went from, there must be something poetic about the two. We had invested in Metarex for our clients this time at 2 rand a share. Commodities markets boom, and Metarex scaled all the way up to 50 rand a share. Global financial crisis struck, and the share price fell all the way back to 2. We were thrilled on the way up, and we watched on the way down. It was a massive mistake for our clients.
Yeah.
Huge mistake.
Look, I think there's many stories like that on the JSE where, you know, even, and those are maybe, you can call them somewhat speculative stocks, but I mean, even perceived blue chip stocks, we've seen some very big disasters like that. And if I look at things like, it's not as bad, but something like an Aspen or a Woolworths, you know, those are also quality stocks that have seen their share prices, you know, drop by 80% from their highs at times. And I've likewise also, you know, worn those scars and thought to myself how to try and avoid that in future. And from my perspective, I look at, well, certainly a decision I've made now is to actually look at some, you have to overlay some sort of a technical indicator with your long-term fundamental thinking. So I've found something like a 50-week moving average as an example. As long as your stock is trading above that or staying, the moving average is still pointing up, you can be long of the stock. But getting out when that thing turns down has saved you from a lot of disasters, I've found. Do you apply any technical thinking to your investment strategy, or is it all fundamentals only?
Technical in the sense that, you know, something like momentum, which I think is a very powerful indicator, provides guidance, I've used the term indicators. I think it is exactly that. I think it's a useful indicator. We don't have rules in our process that if something, you know, crosses above or falls below 200 or something day moving average, we don't have those disciplines in our process. We've got other disciplines that I think, you know, are worth mentioning in passing. The one is if you don't have these scars, then I don't think, well, if you want to be effective in your decision making, I think these scars and mistakes are really, really helpful.
Yeah. they teach you a lot of perspective.
Yeah, it's hard to get this perspective out of textbooks. I think you have to do the yards in reality. Those are the words I'm sort of stumbling around.
Yeah.
But with these types of lessons, we have put in place particular aspects of the process. The one is every single position in our portfolio has an exit valuation. So we have a terminal valuation. And as something gets closer to a terminal valuation, that's not time to change your valuation. It's actually time to start acting on your portfolio decision.
Right.
Whereas in the absence of that, you know, when a share price leaps up, people say, oh, well, hang on, you know, this company must be worth more. Let me change my valuation. So that's sort of one of the disciplines that we've learned over time. The second, and thankfully this was in place with MetaRex, was when a business starts to run up, we were revising our valuations because the copper price was changing. So the facts were changing. The business certainly was worth a lot more. And as it was running up, we were exiting some of the capital. So we sold a lot on the way up. And that meant we banked some of the profit. So it wasn't up to 50, then lose everything all the way back to 2. We certainly had some benefit to show for the experience. But right. I think the point about valuation and process shouldn't be lost.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, we've spoken about worst investments, and you've given us some examples there. Now, and the point you made very well is obviously that it becomes a small portion of a broader portfolio. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. If you lose a 2 or a 3% of the portfolio, you can recover. But when it comes to best investments, this is also something I want to ask you about, because, of course, you know, if you can multiply a share and ride a stock up when it goes up several hundred or several thousands of percent, well, then, of course, your 3% exposure can become very, very significant. So can you tell us about some of your best investments over the years?
Some of the best investments have sat in places, that I described earlier, of that overlooked, unloved, unknown territory. And they would... The names probably would not be well known to many listeners in this audience. They include companies like OneLogix, a logistics business, as the name suggests, which in the late 1990s, early noughties, was trading at 10 cents a share. The business had been abandoned by its capital backers, and one of the principals in the company, Ian Lawrence, who is the founder of a South African business called Postnet, had injected Postnet as the operating business into OneLogix, and over the next 10 years, the share price moved from 10 cents to 3.50 rand. So we made 35 times capital. A similar but different example is a company called Conduit Capital, which was at the time of our investment run by Jason Druin. And what drew us to Conduit Capital under Jason's management was that it was a Ben Graham net-net. It had more cash on its balance sheet than market cap. Tiny, tiny business. No one was looking at it. And it had a market cap of 200 million with 300 million rand cash and listed assets on the balance sheet. On top of that 300 million, it owned an insurance business that was profitable and dividend paying. So we invested into Conduit Capital. We bought as much as 15% of the business. We bought as much as we could, and the share price moved from 50 cents over the next 5 years up to about 3 rand a share. So we made 6 times capital, and that's ignoring or excluding the dividend, where we received back all of our initial capital in dividend. There's a number of those types of examples that for me, you know, really stand out. My favorite example, my most powerful example, is a company called SabVest, historically and now SabCap, run by Christopher Seabrook. And perhaps the thing that resonates here is it's the owner-manager type investment that really sort of speaks to me as having the capacity to sustain and compound. And Chris Seabrook listed SA Bias on the JSE in the late 1980s, I think 1987 or 8, speak under correction. And over the 30 years to now, the company has generated a return on equity of 23% per annum. It's an extraordinary compounder. And owning that business over the 30 years, and I haven't let go of any stock that I've bought, So, you know, I've broken perhaps my rule number one, but I'm invested, you know, alongside him as the principal in this business. That to me, those are the types of companies that really stand out as great successes.
Yeah, fascinating. That's brilliant. Now, obviously, we're living in a very fast-changing world, not always for the better right now with COVID and the pandemic and what have you. It's forced us all to change the way we work and to be more innovative. And at the same time, as much as it's making life difficult, it is also throwing up quite a few interesting opportunities from an investment perspective, I think. Certainly a lot of tech companies offshore that have suddenly, you know, come into focus that maybe were there already, but they're suddenly a whole lot more relevant than what they were before. Are you seeing or doing anything different, and have you changed your approach at all as a result of this COVID? And are you seeing any new investment themes going forward that perhaps weren't there before?
If I go back to your early question or initial question, you know, how would I describe myself as an investor? And, you know, my response was, it's about getting asset allocation right. And if we've done that, then we've built portfolios that are equipped to cope with COVID. You know, I'll only know that, or we'll only know that as a team when we look back in, you know, a year, 3, 5 years time, whenever COVID is truly in the rearview mirror. But I think our strategic asset allocation has held up really well through this period. We've held the line in terms of our SAA, and inside of our SAA, we have permanently had exposure to 5% of the portfolios in physical gold. So, you know, in many times people would say, you know, what the hell are you doing with that physical gold? You know, that's sort of for lunatics and crazies. But it's in this environment where, you know, that type of insurance or protection really comes into its own. And that component of our portfolio has proved to be a valuable component. So it's, maybe I'm, you know, avoiding your question. Is there anything that we've done differently through this? No, we didn't trade furiously. We held our line. We held the SAA. I mean, we monitor actively. We're constantly looking and assessing aspects of the portfolio to satisfy ourselves that the positions are sensible. And if something runs ahead, we'll bank some profit. As it happens in our equity portfolios, we happen to own a particularly profitable South African gold miner called Pan African Resources. Mm. And, you know, going back to my earlier point about taking some money off the table when you recognize or realize valuation, in our active equity portfolios, we've realized a little bit of capital out of Pan African Resources. So, no, it's about making sure that our SAA and TAA are sensible to the environment, that the individual names that make up portfolios have business models and balance sheets that still work, and then applying the process. So I don't want to say, no, there's nothing we can learn. But by and large, our process and approach look the same today as they did in January. Yeah. Or similar.
Okay. Yeah. Consistency. Good.
Yeah.
And now, as we draw towards the end of the interview, Adrian, if a youngster came to you now, let's say you're now Adrian Saville again, you're 13 or 14 years old, you're at school, and you've now got this interest in the market like you did. Say a youngster comes to you and says, I'm interested in the stock market, or I'm interested in investing. What advice can you give me that'll, you know, help to put me on the right footing in my career? What two or three bits of advice would you give to some youngster today?
That's a cool question, Garth. I'm not quite a 13-year-old, but my nephew has developed exactly the fascination that you're describing, and he's in his early 20s. So maybe, you know, I could use him as my example. And what I've tried to encourage him to do is to read widely. So I've shared a substantial investment library with him that Charlie Munger says, look, we got all this way without speaking about Buffett or Munger. But Charlie Munger says some of the most valuable investment and business principles are in a $10 history book. I could not agree more. We keep thinking that, you know, somehow this time is different or this is unique. Anyone who says that hasn't studied history. So, you know, that would be my first urging or guidance to a youngster is read, study history. It is fascinating. It is a valuable guide. The second is learn and understand yourself, because you are going to be your greatest ally and your worst enemy. So spend time with this philosophy, psychology, behavior of investing. So understand what you think makes for a successful investment and how you would identify it, how you would own it, if you are a short-term or a long-term investor, if you are an over, you know, if you're a trader and overnight seems like the long-term. So really understand yourself. And then third, please, please, please do not squander. Garth, you mentioned it. The most valuable ingredient that you have is time. So don't, if you can afford a car for 10, try and buy one for 8. If you're looking at a house worth 11, try and buy one for 9. And it's not about, you know, living lean and mean and denying yourself the luxuries of life, but just small allocations very early on. Give them 50 years of compounding at 20%. Boy, you get powerful results at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Such wise words there. Such wise words. And a final question, Adrian. Soft issue. The last time I saw you, physically saw you in the flesh, yeah, was actually after a Counting Crows concert.
One of us remembers.
Yeah. I know that when I've raised that before the recording, you said it must have been in the fog somewhere, and there was a lot of fog in that concert. So that was the last time we saw each other, Counting Crows concert in Johannesburg. You mentioned also that you were at some point in your life a mobile disco jockey, so you've obviously got an interest in music. Anything capturing your attention? I mean, there's not much music concerts happening right now, unfortunately. This Friday coming up, we've enrolled to attend a Johnny Clegg tribute concert, which I'm really looking forward to.
Oh, nice.
But, you know, just as an aside from all the hard topics of markets and investments, anything interesting on the music front that's capturing your interest at the moment?
I mean, music is my companion and soulmate while I work. So, you know, I'm going to listen to almost anything. I find it engaging, distracting, inspiring. It feeds you. I mean, there's nothing single or particular. Just before we came on to this call, in fact, I said to you, I need to stop the music just before we we came on to this call.
Yeah,
I was listening to some Martin Garrix, Chainsmokers, and Dua Lipa. That's what was on the playlist.
Fantastic. Wonderful. All right, Adrian. Well, it's really been super speaking to you again and catching up after these years. Thanks very much for your time. It's been 40 minutes very well spent for me, so appreciate it. And I look forward to catching up again sometime again in the future.
Brilliant to be with you.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Talking with Traders, brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a leader in the field of online trading involved in this series. Please follow us on Facebook and engage with us there. And a reminder to make sure you subscribe to the series by clicking the subscribe button on your favorite app. Till next time.